You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, do you believe in ghosts? A lot of people do. Around half of all Americans believe in the supernatural. How much can science explain our preference for the paranormal? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, we recently got a very tasty, very controversial question from a listener.
I'm Marissa Wojcik from Madison, and my question is, why do cream puffs get all the attention when the Kringle is the official state pastry of Wisconsin?
When we asked Marissa to explain a little more about her question, she explained that growing up in the Eau Claire area, her family would often have Kringle at family gatherings, so there's some strong nostalgia there. But she says her experience with the jewel of the Wisconsin State Fair, the cream puff, wasn't as impressive. She says maybe she just didn't get a good one. We're here to help Marissa out and try to get to the bottom of what makes each of them popular and which one is the ultimate Wisconsin pastry. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in Cream Puff's corner? Are you squarely a Kringle person? If we had to put one of them, one of those pastries on the state flag, and I say why not, which one would it be? Call in now with your vote. Which do you insist visitors have if you can get into the state fair for that cream puff? Get them out to the Kringle store for the Kringle. 800-642-1234 is the number. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I think we got a poll up there. Paula Hare is with us from Team Cream Puff. She's Director of Marketing and Media Relations for Original Cream Puff, the outfit responsible for producing all those puffs every year at State Fair. Paula, welcome to Central Time.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so proud to represent Original Cream Puffs in this discussion.
And Shauna Seaver is with us for a look at both pastries. She writes and talks about food for television, radio, and the web. She's the author of the cookbook, Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. Shauna, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Paula, let's start with you. Can you just, you know, for people who haven't been to State Fair and had that cream puff there, just give us the basics. What are we biting into there?
Oh, well, our cream puffs contain or really are made from Wisconsin dairy-rich cream and also a very wonderful puff pastry. And biting into them is just like a little piece of heaven. They're only made during this 11-day run of the state fair. That is our original cream puffs. And it's just such a nostalgic, wonderful feeling that fairgoers have in just tasting that first cream puff.
And I think for people in Wisconsin, if you hear the words cream puff, you're thinking state fair, along with fried blank on a
Correct.
Stick. It is the food of the state fair. How did that happen? Why did cream puffs become the Wisconsin State Fair pastry of choice?
Well, certainly cream puffs have been a signature dessert of the Wisconsin State Fair since 1924. So we're coming up on 100 years of cream puffs here at the Wisconsin State Fair. It is certainly the most popular and longest running food item at the State Fair. I mean, picture in your mind, you know, all of the sights and sounds of the fair and the giant Ferris wheel lights and, you know, the cream puffs is having your first cream puff or a cream puff is certainly an experience just like going to the fair. So 1924, that's when they started as a dairy state favorite.
Now, Shauna, before we move over to Kringle, and you're not necessarily, this isn't a debate exactly, but do you have some thoughts on the cream puff as a Midwestern dessert or pastry, I should say?
Well, cream puffs are delightful. What's not to like? This is the most friendly debate ever.
Right.
No, I think cream puffs are great, and especially their place in, you know, Wisconsin food culture. It's just what you said. I mean, it's that nostalgic feel of the state fair, and it's something special that you're not going to have all the time. I mean, and it's something that's like towering and beautiful and delightful and a little over the top. And I think it's just, it definitely has a place, you know, and anything I think that we have, you know, whether it's something, a family recipe we only have at Christmas time, for example, it's going to give you a certain type of delight, right? So that's where I think the cream puff kind of holds a place in our hearts.
So cream puff is the official state fair pastry, but the Kringle is the official Wisconsin state pastry. Why is Kringle such a, I love Kringle. Why is Kringle such a big thing in Wisconsin in particular?
Well, Kringle came to Wisconsin in the late 1800s when there was a huge boom of immigrants from all over Europe in particular. And Wisconsin took a lot of them in. And it was a place where people could come and farm and really create a new life. And of course, there's lots of beautiful land in Wisconsin. And so it became a sort of landing place for a lot of very baking centric countries, lucky for Wisconsin. And the Kringle was, you know, an invention from Denmark. Originally actually started out in a sort of pretzel shape, and you still find them in Denmark baked in that way. And then, like so many other baked goods, sort of evolve as they land in their new home. And like any innovative group of immigrants, they sort of tweaked the Kringle a little bit for local tastes, and it's been around ever since.
We're talking to Shauna Seaver, author of the cookbook Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland, and Paula Hare from Original Cream Puff. We were talking about which is the real Wisconsin pastry, the cream puff associated with State Fair, the Kringle, which is the official state pastry. You could join in with your thoughts on either of those, or if you want to nominate a third-party candidate, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Okay, Paula, with Kringle, I know I can get in a lot of flavors. I can get raspberry. I can get lesser flavors, too. The cream puff, mostly we think of the straight-up cream. There have been some variations, though, right? I think I've seen a chocolate cream puff at the fair, if I'm not mistaken.
That's exactly right. Our original cream puffs are the iconic, the most iconic dessert of the Wisconsin State Fair. And for almost 100 years, it's been the original cream puff as our only flavor. Now, since COVID, like all other companies and bakeries, we have had to pivot. Now, we've had our loyal followers ask us for many years to explore some different flavors, and we were always true to our original cream puffs. But during COVID, we thought maybe this is the time to offer at a very limited time, just like our original cream puffs, only available for 11 days, maybe we should try some different flavors and just see what the community thought of those flavors. And they've gone over like great gangbusters, let me tell you.
What's been the biggest hit for new flavors?
For new flavors, it's been the pumpkin spice cream puffs. So we just had pumpkin spice during Harvest Fest at State Fair. And I can't quite spill the beans, but perhaps there might be a new flavor for the holidays. So I think your listeners will have to check with you or go to Wisconsin or originalcreampuffs.com and check out what our new flavor may or may not be.
Okay, Sean, I got a question for you. Say there's this guy who's a pretty good cook, but he's a so-so baker. So, Shauna, what would be easier for this guy to make at home, a Kringle or a cream puff?
Well, I would say a cream puff is quite a bit simpler in terms of, I mean, not, you know, flavor is wonderful. The textures are wonderful. But in terms of the technique, a choux pastry, which is what a cream puff is typically based on, and then the cream are sort of your two elements. And choux pastry comes together rather quickly, and you can bake it, you know, straight out of the mixer. And it starts on the stovetop, and then you finish it off in a mixer, and then you can dollop your puffs, and then they're baked off. Not sure how Paula makes hers. We're not going to pressure her to divulge her secrets, but
it's
generally
a very closely guarded secret, Shauna.
Yeah, I believe it is because they're delicious. And then when you're talking about Kringle, it's actually based on a Danish pastry, which is kind of similar to a French puff pastry, but there's the addition of yeast, which gives it a little more rise and, of course, that delicious flavor. But it's a laminated dough, which essentially means that you're going to incorporate the butter by rolling and folding the dough several times. And in Midwest Made, in my book, I have a shortcut Danish pastry where you incorporate the butter a little bit differently, and it's a little bit more manageable for the home baker with limited counter real estate. But it involves a lot of rolling and turning and chilling in between rolling. So it can be a couple day process to make yourself a good Kringle, which I think is something that a lot of us take for granted because it's, as you said in the introduction, it's something easy to sort of grab and have you know, for coffee breaks, but they really are very well-crafted, time-consuming pastry.
Well, I'm going to let both of you go and turn things over to our callers now. Shauna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Paula, thanks for being with us.
Oh my gosh, happy to be here.
I've been hearing from Paula Hare, Director of Marketing and Media Relations for Original Cream Puff, and Shauna Seaver, author of the cookbook Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. We are talking about the Wisconsin pastry. Is it the cream puff from the state fair, or is it the Kringle, the actual current Wisconsin official state pastry? What do you think? 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Rusk County. Mike, hi.
Hi. You know, I'm just going to say it's, you know, just look around the state, and that pretty much tells you right there that it's Kringle. I can go to, and I have been, in like Quick Trip stores or other convenience stores or small grocery stores, and I can find a Racine cooked Kringle in a number of different flavors. But I would be hard pressed to find a single Wisconsinite that can find a cream puff anywhere other than the state fair one time a year, maybe a couple of times a year. That right there tells me if it was so popular and so awesome, and I'm not saying cream puffs are bad, I love them, but if they were so awesome, you'd be finding them everywhere.
And Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Heartfelt opinion there. I love it. We'll go now to Lily in La Crosse. Lily, hello.
Hello. I'm going to say I'm Team Kringle. I love Kringles. They are delicious with the fruit filling. And, yeah, you can't go wrong with that. And I will say, I was trying to think of the brand of Kringle that I'm most familiar with. And it was coming from Racine, and I can't remember the name, but it's in that wax.
I'm guessing it's Racine Kringle.
Fold.
That's the brand, is Racine Kringle. Yep. What favorite flavor before I let you go, Lily?
Oh gosh, strawberry. But the most recent one I had was a pumpkin one, and that was really good.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Lily. Well, that fits with what people said on our Twitter survey, a strong Kringle lean, 65%. How about you? It is Kringle versus cream puff for Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. Which is your favorite? Do you go to state fair in hopes of getting that cream puff? 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation here for more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about Wisconsin's dueling pastries, answering a Why Scotson question, saying why do cream puffs get so much hype when Kringle is the official state pastry? It's cream puff. It's Kringle. Which one has your heart, mind, and taste bud? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Thanks, Rob. I want to be careful because I both of these have their place, and I would vote for either one. They're both fantastic. But as a former baker, I've made a ton of both, and I know what the product is supposed to taste like. If you get a soggy cream puff in Wisconsin, it's because it's been sitting around and the whipped cream has started to dissolve, and you know, because those are supposed to be nice and crisp against this softness of the whipped cream. You know what I'm saying? Now, the Kringle is a Danish dough, like the lady was saying. It's laminated, and it's supposed to puff. Well, I've made plenty of Danish in my time. That which makes a Kringle is what I call a mistake. we've all done something in the kitchen where, you know, it's still edible, but it didn't turn out the way you wanted it to. And if you cut a Kringle, or when you cut a Kringle in half and you look at the laminations, the layers of the dough, the more you get into the center, you realize that that dough in the middle is not fully cooked. What I'm trying to say, Rob, is originally it was supposed to be Danish, but the yeast died before it could do its job of puff up the pastry. But it's still edible. It has a unique texture. It's still very good.
Now, hold on. Yeah, that's the thing, Jim. You give me a Danish and you give me a Kringle. I'm taking the Kringle every time. But you're saying a Kringle is just a mistake in Danish?
Try this, Rob. If you ever make Danish dough, it's a pain because of the lamination. But the lady said she's got a quick one. But don't use the yeast. Or if you use the yeast, use like 1/10 of the yeast, okay? And see what the product, see what the final product is like. Okay, because it only rises slightly. The air that's in between the layers is from the lamination. That's when the fat melts away. Okay.
All right, Jim. Thanks for sharing some of the technique behind the Kringle. I love it. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Rick in Nina. Rick, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I'm not really a fan of either of those two baked goods. I would argue and say that the brat bun is what we should be talking about.
The brat bun. Okay, but would you ever eat a brat bun, you know, without, say, I don't know, a brat in the middle of it?
No, but if you're talking Wisconsin, right, and brat bun is definitely like what I think of, right? I don't eat Kringles and I don't eat cream puffs.
Gotcha.
I don't care for either of them.
I love it.
But I definitely eat brat buns.
All right, what condiment, before I let you go, Rick?
Mustard.
Mustard, same. All right. Thanks a lot. A vote for the brat bun for the official pastry of Wisconsin. We are talking about Wisconsin pastry. Which pastry says Wisconsin to you? Is it the cream puff made famous at the state fair? Is it Kringle made famous as Wisconsin's official state pastry? Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us from by Hudson. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to submit another entry. Besides the Kringle and the cream puff, when our family thinks of Wisconsin desserts, we think of the wonderful Norske Nook pies from Osseo, Wisconsin.
Oh, now are you thinking the pies in general or one in particular?
One in particular, I would have to say, is the coconut cream pie. It has a mile-high meringue. You can't really even put it in a box. It's delicious. It's one of our family favorites.
It sounds great, but let me throw this at you. Key ingredient there is coconut. We can't grow that in Wisconsin. Can we still make that our official Wisconsin pastry or dessert?
Well, then let's say any of their wonderful pies that have a meringue or a very high mound of whipped cream on top, that's the Wisconsin dessert to me.
Sounds great, Tom. Thank you. Didn't mean to give you a hard time there, but definitely an iconic Wisconsin dessert item there. Let's go back to your calls now. Dick is with us in Brooklyn. Dick, hi.
Hi, I'd like to vote for the, I like them both, but I think the Kringle is by far the state pastry. You know, and I've had Racine Kringle, but I'll tell you the best Kringle I've had is from Lane's Bakery here in Madison.
Okay, yeah, that's the thing. I haven't gone out and explored a lot of different companies or bakeries' Kringles. Are you a connoisseur? Have you tried them in a lot of different places?
Well, I've had various different Kringles, but as I said, I've really honed in on Lane's, and I like their cherry raspberry. Or cherry cheese are my two favorites.
You had me a cherry raspberry and cherry cheese. Thanks a lot for the call and the recommendation. Might have to check that out. We'll go now to Rana in Cameron. Rana, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm going to throw a wrench into all of this.
Oh, no.
Because I'm a seasonal believer here in Wisconsin. That's why I live here. So I'm going to say cream puff for the summer. The best caramel apple from the best little pumpkin farm you can find in Wisconsin. The Kringle in the winter and the brat bun gets a vote for me for summer.
A bread,
spring.
A pastry for all seasons. I love it. Now, like if I gave you a cream puff in, I don't know, winter, are you going to slap it out of my hand or will you still eat it out of season?
You know, I'll eat it out of season, but I'll have to give it some thought.
Excellent. Rana, I love that. Four pastries to rule them all. That sounds great. We're talking about the best pastry in Wisconsin, the iconic pastry of Wisconsin. It started with a Wisconsin question about cream puff versus Kringle. You can weigh in with other nominations. 800-642-1234 is the number. Eric joins us next in Hazel Green. Eric, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Eric?
I am a Sheboygan hard roll guy.
Sheboygan hard rolls. I've eaten them. Tell us what they are and what you do with them.
Well, I, I was born in Sheboygan County, and we've eaten brats on Sheboygan hard rolls forever, and I've since moved out of Sheboygan County, and oh, it hurts not have a brat on a Sheboygan hard roll.
Do you get care packages from back home, Eric, with the Sheboygan hard rolls?
Whenever family comes to visit, they must bring them.
Excellent. Another great nominee. Thank you for that, Eric. Let's go to Dave now in Madison. Dave, hi.
Hey, I think I can solve this for everybody and we can move on.
What's your solution?
It's if you're looking for the pastry for the state of Wisconsin, it's the crinkle.
The crinkle.
You may know of it as kringle, but it's crinkle is the way it's properly pronounced.
In the original Danish, or?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, somewhere, something like that. But the official thing of the Wisconsin State Fair, there you go, cream puffs. But think about how many cream puffs you see in the state of Wisconsin other than August 5th through the 24th.
Check. I got you, Dave. Thanks for that. Time for at least one more caller. Jennifer is with us in Waukesha. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that for me, the Kringles are just way too sweet. I've only had the Racine Kringles, and to me, they're inedible. They're just way too sweet. So I'm voting for the cream puff if that's where it goes.
So the cream puffs aren't too – you're right. They aren't, like, crazy super sweet. So the breading part isn't as sweet. So that makes the difference for you, a little less sweet?
Yeah, it does. Even the filling isn't – I mean, it's cream and a little bit of powdered sugar, but, yeah, they seem to be reasonable.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Thanks to everybody who called in. Wow, so many comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page as well. Let's read a couple. Mary wrote, Kringles represent Wisconsin. I'd rather eat a cream puff. Tim wrote, the pastry that says Wisconsin to me, the neighborhood bakeries that made and sold them when I was a kid. Ted says, Kringle, cream puffs are just a hamburger bun with whipped cream. Them's fighting words. Cody said, hey, it seems like an Eastern Wisconsin debate over the whole thing. Keep sharing yours over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tomorrow, check out a new episode of Mapped Out. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, many communities in the U.S. have seen a jump in shootings in the last couple of years. The creators of the Violence Project are looking at the causes and possible solutions for a particular kind of incident, mass public shootings. They join the show for a look at their new book on violence in the U.S. and how to prevent it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Democrats say they hope to finalize a social services and climate change package as soon as this week and create a new tax for billionaires to help pay for it. We'll look at how that could work and whether it will end up in the final bill. First, a new book lays out the causes and potential solutions to public mass shootings in the United States. Mass shootings have gotten more common in recent years. More than half of all public mass shootings since 1966 have been committed since the year 2000. They've also gotten deadlier. 8 of the 20 deadliest mass shootings in modern history were committed in the last 5 years. Then President Barack Obama talked about the trend in 2015 after the Umpqua Community College shooting in Roseburg, Oregon, where 10 people died, including the perpetrator.
Somehow this has become routine. The reporting is routine. My response here at this podium ends up being routine. The conversation in the aftermath of it, we've become numb to this.
Our guests say amid the tragedy, there is some good news. There are a lot of proven strategies that can help prevent future shootings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests who have put a lot of time and effort over the years into studying the causes of these public mass shootings, talking to the perpetrators and their families in many cases? Are there solutions you think we are overlooking, not putting enough attention into? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University. James Densley is a professor and department chair of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul. They created the first ever comprehensive database of public mass shootings in the United States, and their new book is called The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. Jillian and James, welcome both of you back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
James, in a past conversation, you talked about the different kinds of gun-related violence in the United States, in many cases requiring different solutions. I want to talk about this category you're focusing on, public mass shootings. First of all, can you just tell us about the definition, what that means?
Yeah, so we are using in the book and throughout our research a common definition that's been agreed upon by the FBI and by academic researchers, meaning four or more people killed in a public space. That might include a school or a place of worship, a bar or a restaurant, a workplace. And these are also crimes that tend to not have a relationship between the offender and the victims. And what we mean by that is that it's not a domestic homicide. And it's also not a homicide that occurs in the course of usual criminal behavior. So this is not a drug deal gone bad. But this is more a case of when somebody's out on the street really trying to take as many lives as possible in a public shooting.
A key point, Jill, that you've thought about for years before even this research started is it's easy to think of people who do a monstrous thing like this, a public shooting, trying to take as many lives, as James was just saying, as possible, to think of them as monsters. But you say that isn't really a productive way to think about them. Why not?
Right. And before I was an academic, I was an investigator and I worked with people facing the death penalty. And we had this saying, which was the worse the crime, the worse the story. And these are just horrific crimes that it's easy to say that the person who does this must be a monster. But that monster label doesn't get us any closer to actual prevention. When it's just a monster, it feels like there's nothing we can do about it besides practice running and hiding and fighting and give our kids bulletproof backpacks. But the reality is if we can look at what that pathway to violence looks like over time for these individuals and really try to understand that build towards this act throughout their life, that gets us closer to really coming up with more holistic prevention strategies.
James, can you talk about the effort the two of you went to try to learn those stories? Talking to, as I mentioned earlier, perpetrators, surviving perpetrators themselves, family members, victims, and others.
Yeah, that's right. So many mass shooters intend their shooting to be their final act. And so that many of them die in the act, or they're killed by law enforcement, or they take their own lives. There's a very small number of those individuals still alive. We wrote to all of them, as many as we possibly could find, fitting our definition. And we were surprised to get letters back that people wanted to talk to us. In the end, when we went through that process with the corrections department, because all these individuals are in prison for the rest of their lives, we were able to interview five mass shooters in prison. We were also then able to interview some of the people that knew them, family members, friends, and others in the orbit of their lives. What was then incredible about this project is as we started to get a bit more attention for the work that we were doing, people started reaching out to us with stories to tell. So we ended up spending a couple of years flying around the country, meeting with survivors of mass shootings, with family members who'd lost loved ones to these tragedies, first responders, and others who had a story to tell and a perspective on this issue. We really immersed ourselves in their lives to better understand this this phenomena. In addition to building this database, which tracks mass shootings all the way back to 1966, based on a whole host of life history variables. So we really tried to come at this from a, what we would call a mixed methods approach and look at it from all angles and all perspectives.
And Jill, there's not a magic profile that's going to predict who is going to commit a mass public shooting. That said, you found many common themes in these stories. What stood out to you the most?
Yeah, that's right. There's no kind of checklist we can go through to figure out if someone is going to be a mass shooter. But what we did see is these common pathways. So starting with really significant early childhood trauma, things like sexual abuse, physical abuse, the parental suicide. Then you saw number of mental health concerns over time, leading to a real crisis point where the individual often became actively suicidal and their behavior was changing. People were noticing that they were acting different than they normally do. One sister described it as they go from thinking, what's wrong with me, what's wrong with me, what's wrong with me, to what's wrong with them. And so there's this shift, which comes the kind of hate and anger and who they blame for their misery. And then finally, there's access to weapons, to guns, and to the location that represents their grievance.
We're talking to Jillian Peterson and James Densley, authors of the new book, The Violence Project: How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. You can join in with your questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. James, when it comes to solutions, I think a lot of people have a simple solution: more security in public places, fewer guns, more mental health care, whatever the case may be. It's going to take, it seems like, if I'm reading you two right, a lot of little things, a lot of big things. There's not just one simple solution, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's about being comfortable with the complexity. And that's difficult because we're always searching for simple solutions to complex problems. And unfortunately, there's nothing there that's that easy. Now, that being said, there is some good news, which is to say that we've spent so much time pitting imperfect solutions off against each other. So we say it's either mental health or it's guns. And we are basically saying, well, can't it be both? And also, can't it be more than that too? So what we've done in the book is really try to organize solutions around things that our society can do, and that might take a bit of an act of Congress and a bit of a heavier lift, but also what institutions can do. So what can schools and workplaces and communities do to change the culture within their organizations to potentially prevent a mass shooting? And then also, what can we do as individuals to prevent a tragedy from occurring? And some of that stuff is really simple, and it's stuff that we can do right here, right now. Things around safe storage of firearms, for instance, which doesn't require any legislation. It's just something that we can all pledge to do and to support one another. And the one cool thing about this, we think, is that in addition to preventing a mass shooting, there's a diffusion of benefits that we could be preventing a suicide or an accidental shooting or a firearm getting into the hands of somebody that shouldn't have it. Or we might just be checking in with a young person who's struggling at that one moment and needs a simple act of kindness to get through the day and realize that life's still worth living and that they don't have to go ahead and perpetrate such a horrendous crime to get the attention they feel like they need. So it's a diffusion of benefits that gets us to think about violence prevention holistically. And that's why we're hopeful, actually, coming out of this research project, that as Barack Obama said at the beginning of your show, it does feel routine, but we don't have to be resigned to that routine. There is something we can do to break the cycle.
We are talking about mass public shootings in the United States with Jillian Peterson and James Densley. Their new book is called The Violence Project: How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to be done to prevent these mass public shootings? Our guest created the first ever comprehensive database of these kind of incidents. They talk to survivors, even perpetrators of these shootings. What do you want to know from them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with criminologists Jillian Peterson and James Densley about their new book, The Violence Project: How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions on the topic. Let's go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. I want to first say I'm a total anti-gun person, and for many years I've been in arguments with people. So I've been looking for things that might make some sense. And I heard a gentleman decades ago who said, when you come up in front of a judge and they want to charge you with this, that, and the next thing, you can never get out of that gun charge. You have to be brought up on a gun charge. Back when I was a kid, a million years ago, people used to put a comb in their pocket because they didn't want to get caught robbing somebody with a gun. And the other thing is, if people treat guns like cigarettes, you know, people came to your house and smoked in your house, even if you were a non-smoker. Now, hey, you can't smoke in my house. You know, you can't smoke in my restaurant. I'm not going to send my kids to your house because they might get secondhand smoke. Treat guns like cigarettes. And those are my two ideas. And I thank you for letting me say them.
Chris, thanks for the call. Chris, Jillian talking about, in some ways, in that last part, changing our attitude, our cultural thoughts about guns. What do you think?
Yeah, our data would really agree with that. So we found, for example, school shooters, the vast, vast majority of them, they're too young to buy guns. They're students of the school. So they're taking them from family and family members, friends, grandparents. And so if those guns were just stored in a safe way that young people didn't have access, that would have a huge impact. And we also found a number of things that our data supports, things that kind of slow down the gun buying process. So if somebody is in crisis, is suicidal, is a threat to hurt somebody else, what can we do to make it a little bit harder for them to get their hands on guns? Things like universal background checks, things like red flag laws, things like permit to purchase wait times. So our data really supports some of those kind of common sense gun measures that really do have a lot of public support.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We'll go to another Chris in Kenosha now. Chris, hello.
I just wanted to touch up on that a little bit. So currently the government is allowed to have like a database of gun registration information, but it can't be computer searchable, if I'm correct about that. And another thing about that is, if it was computer searchable, then we would be able to enforce, you know, these red flag laws and all of that. And I just wanted that to be brought up.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. I understand there's the equivalent of a card catalog for many gun references. James, does the federal government have enough tools to even research things like gun violence?
Yeah, it's a challenge because for a long time there were restrictions on, for example, the CDC to be able to research gun violence as a public health issue. And that was a barrier to really understanding the phenomena. I think the other piece about this as well is resourcing for the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms. They have been chronically under sort of resourced over the years. And this has been a barrier for instance, tracking how legal firearms get into the illegal marketplace. So what you might have is, for example, corrupt firearms dealers who are selling to prohibited purchasers. But because of the lack of resources to be able to investigate those cases, they're unable to do so. And what we saw in our research and we write about in the book is examples where people shouldn't have been in possession of firearms because they had, for instance, a history of domestic violence or criminal history or other issues. But because of some certain loopholes in the system, they kind of fell through the cracks. And so a lot of this is about enforcing the laws that are on the books, but that takes resources to ensure that that people are doing what they can do to follow through on these issues.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We're talking to James Densley and Jillian Peterson, authors of the new book, The Violence Project, about ways to prevent public mass shootings in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jillian, something that stood out to me reading the book is there's a gap. If you're a teacher worried about a particular student or someone worried about a family member, you're worried that they're going to have some kind of outburst. They've had that proximate cause. They've got that background of trouble. The options are, in many cases, do nothing or call the police. The police don't have a lot of options. They can arrest someone or they can maybe hospitalize someone. Do we need something in the middle there, some kind of a mental health crisis option?
Absolutely. That is certainly what we found. We talked to mothers who would say, I was very worried about my son, but what was I going to do? Call the police on my own son and say, I think he might do something that he hasn't already done. And the police have nothing to do in those situations. So what we do need is we advocate for crisis response teams. So teams in schools and workplaces and community organizations where people can report if they're worried about someone, even anonymously, and that concern is met with intervention that is caring, that is empathetic, that really tries to match that person's needs. So not focused on criminally charging somebody, not focused on excluding them, firing them, suspending them, but really focused on figuring out what this person needs to get through this crisis point and what that long-term follow-up looks like. And we have those resources. We just have to sort of allocate our time and attention a bit differently to really be focused on prevention instead of reaction.
Let's bring on another caller now. Kevin is with us in Madison. Kevin, hi.
You know, I was commenting to your screener. It seems that what we've been doing is just kicking the can down the road as far as like the accountability. So we have everyone trying to be the same. Then somebody's a bully, and then we don't want to have bullies. And I don't think we should have bullies, but bullies are a necessary evil that you have. It corrects itself when kids are younger. I think what we do is we try to placate, we try to make everyone the same, we try to get everyone through the school system, and because these lessons, we don't let the children learn these lessons when they're 4, 5, 6 years old, that if this is what it manifests itself into. We've got 30 years of anti-bullying and prevention, and I think what it is, you know, here we close out another month of Bully Prevention Month, and what do we have to show for it? We got more school shootings.
Kevin, thanks for the call. James, the approach to an issue like bullying in schools, what do you think?
Yeah, it's we do see that mass shooters have experienced bullying at some time in their lives, but also that in some cases that they were themselves the bullies. And I think really what it speaks to is just where we focus our time and attention within the school building. We've really got to build climates within our school that are conducive to care and compassion and support to eradicate things like bullying. So that they are not, plaguing people's lives and changing their trajectories. And I think in turn, we want to be thinking about, we have spent billions of dollars over the years on a school safety apparatus, which is really built around the kind of run, hide, fight, hardened security type of model. And could we have spent those resources differently on smaller class sizes, more counselors in schools, better crisis intervention protocols within our school communities? Whether that could have nipped in the bud some of the challenges that the caller was talking about and have steered people off of the pathway to violence later in life. And so a lot of it's just around where we put our resources and how do we support our teachers and our school administrators to ensure that they have the resources they need to provide a safe school environment for every child.
Thanks for that call. Kevin, in our last minute or so, Jillian, do you feel like the message you two are sending is being heard by people who are making important decisions about how to spend our resources most effectively to prevent these shootings?
I think it's starting. Here in Minnesota, we saw 2 years ago, the legislature passed $25 million for hardened security and bulletproof doors. And then just this last session, they also passed a new school safety budget, but this time it was about suicide prevention and counselors in schools and crisis intervention teams. So we are starting to see that shift. One of the reasons we wrote this book really for a broad audience was to really try to bring other people with us kind of through this journey that we went on in understanding this phenomenon. And the last chapter of the book is called Hope. It's really about what each of us can do to shift this narrative and really try to prevent this violence from occurring.
We'll leave it there. Jillian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And James, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University in Minnesota. James Densley is a professor and department chair of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul. They talked to us about their new book, The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. By the way, if you or a loved one are struggling with suicidal thoughts, you can find help 24 hours a day at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The number there is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at Democrats' plans to impose new taxes on the very wealthiest Americans, part of the effort to pay for infrastructure and social spending packages. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network.